show that looks at Kansas City baseball's past, present, and future.
High fly ball. Motley going back to the track. No outs to go. The Royals have won the 1985 World Series.
Davis comes to the plate. Strike three called. It's over. They've done it. The Royals are World Series champions. The world champion Kansas City Royals.
This is the Kansas City Baseball Vault.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome in to the Kansas City Baseball Vault, brought to you by Kelly's Westport Inn. Folks, we're still in the offseason, but the Royals are still World Series champions. So regardless, we have some things to talk about. Before we get started, I, of course, am your host, Jeff Herr, and with me is the demonstrative Michael Engel, who will be less demonstrative for feeling a little tickle in the throat these days. But, you know, it's that time of year, so it is to be expected. But, Mike, how are you doing this evening besides what I just mentioned?
Other than the cold that I got from my family back at Thanksgiving, I'm doing okay.
It's always something, isn't it?
Yeah, they were all getting over a cold as I arrived, and then
that's the worst.
I brought it back east with me, so it was great. But they fed me all week, so
I guess there are trade-offs. Of
course. I'll take it.
Yeah, I'm definitely not looking forward. As many, if you listen to the show, as many know, I'm expecting my first child in February. Not looking forward to the days when she goes to school with all these kids with runny noses and no Kleenexes, and she comes home and brings just a pack load of germs with her and probably gets my wife and I sick. So that's a few years down the road, thankfully, but
yeah,
you know, soon enough, those are the joys of parenting, as it were. But it's still been kind of quiet, you know, for the Royals. And today was actually the first day that, and just all baseball, not just the Royals that have been quiet, it's all baseball. And so today was kind of the first day, and wouldn't you know it, it's December. Usually December kind of kicks things off for the baseball offseason, and it has kicked it off in a big way today. And we'll have, we'll save that big part for the second segment of the show. But first, just some kind of news and notes items. First one, with the Royals specifically, they've signed Tim Collins to a 1-year deal. So there is that. Tim Collins coming off Tommy John surgery. When did he have it? Was it?
It was the start of last year.
Last year? Okay, yeah. I couldn't remember if it was end of last season-ish or this year or when it was, but
yeah, he didn't pitch at all in 2015. I think he did in spring training, if I remember, but yeah, I mean, he hadn't thrown pitching a game since 2014.
So yeah, Tim Collins signed. I mean, he was a good pitcher. He had his moments, and he's definitely worth keeping around, especially when, you know, the Royals emphasizing the depth in the bullpen. So do you have the figures on that? I just saw the news flash that he signed. I didn't see what the amount was for.
I think it was the same amount that he made last year, which is like $1.5 million. He was arbitration eligible, so they had to offer him a contract or let him go. And, you know, I think they must have figured, since they went through, you know, you've got Duffy, who they still want to have in the rotation. They've got Franklin Morales, who's going to be free agent. Brandon Finnegan, who they traded. You know, they don't really have a lot of left-handed relievers. And so for Collins, who's not really like a lefty specialist, but he's at least left-handed, it seemed like, well, we already sat through him for 1 year. We might as well bring him back.
Yeah,
just you know, it's minimal. I mean, it's, you know, $1.5 million isn't that big of an investment. So,
I mean, based on the Royals payroll last year, less than 1%.
Yeah.
So breaking the bank to sign.
Signing Collins isn't going to prevent them from signing somebody else.
Right.
He's basically making what Jason Frazier made to start the year last year. And that's, you know, same level of minimal you know, minimal investment. It's just is what it is. And that's about it. That's it for your Royals postseason.
That's your Royals news. Yay.
That's all they've done. Really. I mean, they added Bubba Starling and Kyle Zimmer to the 40-man roster to protect them from the Rule 5 draft. And they have to decide on Drew Butera and Greg Holland and there's somebody else I'm forgetting for arbitration contract tenders, which you know, either of those could be non-tendered. You know, they don't necessarily expect to offer contracts to either of them.
Yeah, the Royals are expected to non-tender Holland, but I'm guessing there's a Hochaver-like deal to be worked out. With the agreement is we're not going to tender you, but hey, sign this contract for $2 million plus incentives. So if you come back from Tommy John, we'll pay you this. And then if you do well after coming back, you can make decent money.
Yeah. And that's pretty much assumed. Pretty much as soon as he went down, that was kind of the assumption. So I think that's going to be fine. And that, I mean, that's really it. That's about all that's going on. The Royals are still in pursuit of Alex Gordon and Ben Zobrist. Zobrist is highly in demand. He's, I think just earlier tonight, Jeff Passan from Yahoo mentioned that he's expecting about 4 years and $60 million. We'll talk in the second segment about how that value might relate to the Royals and value of player contracts in general. And, you know, just on the face of it, seems like that's going to be too much for the Royals to compete with. He's said to be in the works of trying to figure out where he's going to sign within like the next week. So, seems like he's probably not going to be coming back.
No. And that's something we kind of talked about where all things being equal, I think Ben Zobrist would like to be in Kansas City. And obviously the Royals want him in Kansas City, but I think they want Gordon more. So in terms of priority, they have prioritized Gordon over Zobrist. And I honestly do think that Zobrist would be inclined to kind of wait it out and see. But each day that passes, that becomes less and less likely and harder. And eventually somebody's going to pop on Zobrist with the exact deal that he had in mind. Yeah, and this will be something... Yeah, and this will be something we'll kind of talk about in the second segment with as far as baseball and salaries and stuff. But, you know, somebody's going to want him bad enough that they're going to say, we're going to give you a deal that there's just no way you can't. And offer, you know, the Godfather line, you know, make you an offer you can't refuse. Somebody's going to say $18 million a year for Ben Zobrist and let's just end this now, sign it and be done. And he'll do it. And I won't blame him one bit. But, you know, that's the unfortunate part of the Royals situation. There's a world where they could make a Ben Zobrist and Alex Gordon signing together work, but in this climate and baseball and this the time frame it would take to work that out for where the Royals are, it's just not possible. So I was hopeful a couple weeks ago. The hope started dwindling by the day
pretty rapidly.
And yeah,
it's
so
like, everybody wants this veteran with great character who can switch hit and play every position and has some power and good plate patience. Go figure.
And if I were to say
series ring, so it's like,
if I were to equate my hope for signing Ben Zobrist in terms of my hope for the Royals winning a World Series by year, I would say a couple weeks ago, I was like 2015 Royals, right? As far as my hope that we'd sign, that they'd sign Zobrist.
We can do
now
whatever.
I'm at like 2011 Royals. So, like, you know,
maybe,
you know, if literally everything went right for the Royals and everything went wrong for everybody else, then yeah. But the sheer odds of that happening are slim to none, and slim is on its way out the door.
Right. I think if, like, Gordon expects to get the bigger contract, and as he should, and it seems like if the Royals would have been able to get Gordon by now, then they may be able to go get Zobrist. You know, kind of like, you know, Tim Collins for $1.5 million doesn't prevent you from signing anybody else, but if you get Zobrist early, that might prevent you from getting Gordon later. Whereas the opposite of that may not be true. Like, if they get Gordon, at least they're already invested. Now it's like, okay, well, let's go ahead and get Zobrist too. You know, at that point, he's a little lower of an annual salary, a little smaller contract. I mean, we'll. I don't. At the way it's shaping now, I don't expect Zobrist back. Which, you know, he gave us a few good
sets.
Yeah, it's you know, it's like we talked about last time. He seemed like he fit right in immediately, in every way. You know, lineup wise, on the field, in the clubhouse, very likable. You know, but he's got a new kid. They've got to do what they got to do, and can't really blame him for it. So I figure probably next time we talk on here, it's going to be talking about where he signed. And if I had to guess, I'd say the Mets. They seem like they're really in pursuit of him. And Daniel Murphy is gone. And I don't think they're going to try to re-sign him unless they don't get Zobrist. So he seems like their top guy.
Yeah. And, you know, when you're in a situation like Zobrist where, you know, not only everything that we've talked about, but when the Royals can come to you and say, hey, we really want you here, but we have to get this deal worked out with Alex Gordon, versus the Mets coming and saying, there's nobody else that we want more than you. Tell us what it takes. We'll start from there. You know, that just gives you a different feeling. And Zobrist doesn't really seem like a New York kind of guy, for whatever that's worth, but that's only worth so much as the amount of zeros on the paycheck. You know, you can get over that
right
quite easily.
You can make it work.
Yeah. So, I mean, and it would be kind of a, and I mentioned this in our email chain, we were talking about this, and it's one of those things where the only thing that I think preventing Ben Zobrist from signing with someone else right now is all this goodwill that the Royals have brought up, which is just so phenomenal that it's happened so quickly. You know, 2 years ago, if we were going into the 2014 season before the Royals had made the playoffs and won the World Series and all that, you would say, man, you know, the Royals are maybe trending upward, but they don't stand a chance at getting a guy like Ben Zobrist. He doesn't really care about coming to the Royals. It's just not going to happen.
Yeah.
But they're, now you think, okay, yeah, but now you think, okay, not only did the Royals win the World Series, but he was on the team. He likes Kansas City. They've built up a lot of goodwill. So I think that's the only reason he's lasted that long, to be honest, because there's Ben Zobrist, and I heard this on 610 on the drive with Parkins and CDOT. Danny Parkins was saying, you know, the competition for, in terms of other players on the market for someone like Alex Gordon is heavy, you know, because you've got Alex Gordon. He's definitely in that kind of first tier of free agent outfielders, but that tier also includes people that are players that are above him, a definite above him, and a Jason Hayward type player. Mm-hmm. And then someone who, you know, when you look at Upton, he's kind of, you know, you could make an argument probably either way for Upton versus Gordon, whichever way you want to go with that. But, you know, so there's quite a bit more competition versus the switch hitting Swiss Army knife utility guy who plays a above average second base and pretty much above average every position that he plays. So there's really no competition. So there's no market to set. And if there was, he'd be the one setting it. So yeah, it doesn't really matter as far as timing. You know, normally a lot of the positions and the big deals you see, there's kind of the one that starts the dominoes falling.
Right.
And so I think with that, I think Jason Hayward kind of sets the market there a little bit. And then you see the Gordons and the Uptons of the world follow after that. So there's none of that going on with Ben Zobrist. He's just kind of, he's out there. He'll do what he wants. And so, you know, yeah, is what it is.
He's the guy. The only other kind of similar second base type is like Howie Kendrick is probably the next guy in that group. And, you know, he only plays second. So
I was about to say, yeah, he's definitely not, others, he's not nearly as versatile.
Other guys would be like Emilio Bonifacio, Alberto Callaspo, Asdrubal Cabrera, Meiser as tourists. I mean, that's about, you know, that's nothing against those guys, but they're not quite Ben Zobrist.
They're not Ben Zobrist.
So, yeah, that's a good point. Well, speaking of departures, Andy McCullough, beat writer for the Kansas City Star,
is
going to be going to the LA Times to cover the Dodgers. So we'll see who the next beat writer is going to be. I don't know. We'll see. Maybe they'll get a blogger. Maybe it'll be Dave Lasky or Craig.
Maybe they'll break the mold and not hire some journalist student or somebody from a smaller paper. And they'll go, you know, honestly, I mean, there's something to be said for that, you know, because you look at something like 610, you know, and they've, you know, they're doing a lot better now in terms of ratings versus 810. A lot of that was helped, I think, because of the Royals and everything, Royals being on 610. But part of their struggle has been going up against 810, and they've brought in a lot of out of state guys, kind of rising talents, if you will, to try and compete that way. But one of the things that 810's always had going for them, everyone's local guys, you know, they're all local. This is their destination job. They're not looking to bounce to New York and things like that. And, you know, with the exception of Nick Wright, which that was a contract negotiation thing that kind of screwed them out of that. But, you know, and that's why I think that 610 is making Carrington Harrison a priority, because he's a local guy. I think he's someone that they feel like they could keep around and want to. So, I mean, there's some merit to the idea that, you know, doesn't have to be a blogger, but just that the idea of someone who's from the city, has ties, and that would be kind of a destination type thing, because, you know, you had Dutton for, was it 20 or 25 years? 20 years?
When he was the primary beat guy, I think he started around like 93.
I want to say 93.
I don't remember. I know he covered a lot of other things. He covered like Big 12 stuff and things like that.
Right.
But I mean, he covered the Royals in different parts of the year from like 86 on. So at some point, you know, Flanagan was covering it there. And
you had Mellinger adding in on the, was it the Ball Star blog? Is that what they?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then, Rustin Dodd was kind of understudy for a while before he took over the KU beat. So, you know, they had that continuity with Dutton for a while. And then now McCullough comes in and McCullough leaves. You know, whether he was intending for the Star to be a springboard into a better opportunity, or it just so happened that it came, you know, it's always hard to tell. You know, and it's he's going to LA, huge market, getting to cover the arguably the biggest market team outside of the Yankees, you know, gonna have a lot more readership in the LA Times. So congratulations to him, and you know, good for him getting his due. So he was a guy, just me personally, at first I was just kind of like, you know, he seems like an okay writer, a serviceable beat guy. But over the last 2 years, and I think the Royals having so much success probably helped.
Yeah.
But he really kind of grew into being a very good writer. And by the end of his tenure, being now, I definitely respect his talent quite a bit. So, you know, good for him.
His story on the wild card game.
Man, that was something else.
Incredible. That was probably the best baseball thing I read all year. So,
yeah, and then he's had, you know, would he have that profile on Lorenzo Cain that he wrote?
Yep, that was right? That was really good too. So he
a lot of his long form stuff is really good.
Yeah, it is. It is, and you know, they'll find another good writer. I mean, the Star is a good job. It's always been a pretty good sports paper. You know, Whitlock, Posnanski, they came through here. So, you know, say what you want about Whitlock, but you know, he's, you know, guy who moves the dial, and Posnanski is one of the best regarded sports writers ever. So it's not a bad place to land if they're looking to bring somebody else in, or if they're looking to bring somebody up from within Kansas City. We'll see.
Yeah. So congrats to him. Good luck in LA. And we will be anxiously awaiting as we see who the Kansas City Star is going to get to be the next person that gets peppered with completely asinine questions on Twitter constantly about the Royals. And at least You know, what's funny is right after the World Series, it started almost immediately with the Gordon and Zobrist re-signing talk. And I don't know that the Dodgers have been linked a ton to Ben Zobrist, but if he were to show up tomorrow and be like, hey, I'm on Twitter, the new, you know, he's going to get a pouring of Ben Zobrist questions from Dodgers fans, just because everybody's going to ask Ben Zobrist questions because everybody wants him, and they should, because he's awesome.
It's true.
But actually, if Zobrist doesn't sign with the Royals, I have a huge positive out of this, Mike. I don't know if you've thought about this, but Ben Zobrist jerseys would be on crazy sale if he doesn't sign.
They would.
And you better believe I would totally buy it. Because if I ever described to you the Jeffers jersey curse, have I told you this before?
I think you might have, but remind me.
So we called it the jersey curse. It started who did it start with? It started with the Chiefs when I was in I don't even know how old I was. Let's see, it would have been 95 when they went 13-3. So I was 10 years old. So this is when it started, right? So that was kind of when jerseys first started becoming really big, because before that they were always the blank ones, like the college looking ones, you know, with the real thick mesh. And they didn't have the names on the back. Like, I have a Montana jersey. It just says 19. It doesn't actually say Montana on the back. It's just a Chiefs 19 jersey.
Yeah, you just have to know that it's Montana.
Yeah, once they started putting those, though, on the back, the names, that's when they started kind of blowing up. So the year the Chiefs were really good in 95, I got a Tamarack Vanover jersey. Okay? So we all know how that turned out.
Sound investment.
Right. And then, let's see. Then after that, it went to Andre Rison, and that that ended the way that ended. And then I said, I want to pick a jersey of someone who's going to stick around for a while. And so I got Neil Smith, and then he was traded, or he went and signed with the Broncos, won two Super Bowls, and the Chiefs did not. And then after that, it was Donnie Edwards. This is shortly before he left for the Chargers. I can't remember if that was a trade or if that was free agency. I never even got to wear that jersey when he was Chiefs. I bought it. It was like some off-season sale thing. I think it was down like Osage Beach or something. And next, it was at like an outlet store on sale. Bought it. Literally like 2 days later, the news comes out that he's traded or whether he's signed somewhere. I honestly cannot remember if he was traded or what, but so then there goes that. and then let's see. After that, it was I'm drawing a blank now on who those were, but I told my mom, I said, don't do it, Mom. When the Chiefs drafted Glenn Dorsey, top five overall, I said, don't buy me a Glenn Dorsey jersey. And she bought it anyway. He's gone. One of my
bought one earlier for him, though.
Yeah, that's true. One of the guys that I was a fan of in college was Brody Croyle. So when the Chiefs drafted him, I was super pumped about that. I got a Brody Croyle jersey. We all know how that turned out. the one in between that I was missing was Snoop Menace.
Oh yeah,
loved Snoop Menace.
Mark Boerichter.
No Mark Boerichter. Oh. I did not get a Mark Boerichter.
I didn't even get his name right.
Yeah.
That's how fleeting he was. He has one thing that he ever did. 99-yard touchdown.
He's in the record books forever and ever now. Let's see. And then the most recent one was Brandon Flowers. And, of course, he got cut. He's on the Chargers right now. So a few years ago, I bought like an old school like sweater jersey thing for Bobby Bell. I'm like, you know what? I'm just rocking the Bobby Bell one till the day I die, because he's always going to be a Chiefs Hall of Famer. No one's going to question me for wearing it. That's all I got. But for the Royals, since jerseys aren't as much of a thing in baseball, but I did have a Billy Butler jersey. We all know how that turned out.
There you go.
So I was hesitant to buy a Ben Zobrist jersey. Is the moral of that story, but just because,
you can,
but
and it's
even And that's how much I love Ben Zobrist. Even though he was only with the team for 3 months, if he were to leave, I would still buy a jersey on sale.
It's totally fair. In related so with news, that, we're going to start a Kickstarter for the Jeff Herr, Omar Infante jerseys.
There you go. Let's use this power for good.
And we'll report back before spring training.
Yes, please, please. So on that note, I think we'll go ahead and take our first break here. And then when we get back, we've got some the news of the day to talk about and kind of what that news means for the Royals. So stick with us, and we will see you on the other side.
The Kansas City Baseball Vault will be right back after these messages. The Vault.
Hey, Troy, what are you doing this weekend?
Gonna grab a beer somewhere. What do you have in mind?
I heard about this awesome new bar downtown. It's called Rage. The waitresses have a contest to see who has the most piercing.
Oh, man, that's not really my scene.
Well, there's another bar close by called Spit Cup. Check it out. The bartenders wear chaps, and every hour they shoot a guy.
No, seriously, I just want a bar where I can sit down and watch the game.
Okay, I've got just the place. It's called Lilac. Sit on pillows, and you drink from eucalyptus leaves.
No, Ned, but I just want a place where I can get a cheap drink and watch the football game.
Okay, I got it. This place, it's got a TV. It's called 816.
Limitosis.
Yep. All their drinks come in NBA hats.
Man, I just want a place like Kelly's.
Oh, you mean Kelly's Westport Inn? No, they've got all the basketball and bowl games. They've even got a heated roof. The view is really nice, too, if you know what I'm saying. Why didn't you just say you wanted to go to Kelly's?
Kelly's Westport Inn, 500 Westport Road. Make it your place to go any time of the week. Tell them the Royal Man Report sent you.
And welcome back to the Kansas City Baseball Vault, brought to you by the very place you heard in our commercial break, Kelly's Westport Inn. And if you're looking for anything this holidays as far as a place to go, Mike has some additional information for you about what might be a good place.
Yep. Mitch Kelly, who runs Kelly's, he told us good idea for a holiday party. If you had a last-minute holiday party, could be anybody from 10 to 200 people. They always have drink specials. There's food options available. If you're interested in using Kelly's Westport Inn as your last-minute holiday party destination, just give them an email at info@kellyswestportinn.com. If you want to drop in a line that you heard about them from us, that would be cool too. They continue to support us on this show so that we can host it online and actually, provide content.
Which is nice.
For us, at least. Your mileage may vary.
Indeed. So, yes, Kelly's Westport Inn. If you need a party, they're your place. And if you don't need a party and you just want a place to hang out,
it's fine.
They're
too.
Pretty cool too. So, now we'll. We kind of teased before the break, big news of the day. So here it is. Mike, you ready for this? I know you're ready for this. We already talked about it. but I hope your listeners are ready for it. And I'm sure if you haven't heard about it by the time we recorded this, which doesn't really matter, but surely you've probably heard about it by the time you're listening to this. David Price, signed with the – I don't know if he's officially signed yet, but the agreement has or the contract has been agreed upon for 7 years, $217 million for an average annual value of $31 million a year. Breaks Clayton Kershaw's record. He is the highest average annual value paid player in baseball. Mike, your thoughts?
That's a lot of dog biscuits. That's a lot of money. I mean, there were questions that David Price was going to get the $200 million that he wanted, just because his playoff performance, which is ridiculous. He's top five pitcher, multiple, you know, Cy Young Award contender. He's been one of the best pitchers since he made it into the league. There's no reason why other than salaries are ridiculous, no reason why he shouldn't be among the top five paid pitchers in baseball. That's a lot of money, and the Red Sox are sending a big message. But yeah, it's that's kind of the first domino in the chain, as you might say. And I think you're going to start seeing some things take off from here now that he's off the market. It kind of sets where the value is for a pitcher of his caliber. We kind of saw that a little bit when Jordan Zimmermann signed with Detroit. He got 5 years and $110 million for about $22 million a year, which is seems like a lot to me for Jordan Zimmermann, but you know, he's $100 million pitcher kind of guy. And Johnny Cueto was reportedly offered 6 years and $120 million from the Diamondbacks and turned it down. So the market's starting to kind of take shape. You start to see where the value for player contracts is. And David Price is, you know, right out in front of everybody so far this offseason. So if you want a top five Cy Young contending pitcher, it looks like $31 million a year is the going rate.
There it is. You know, it's amazing. And I made this comment on Twitter today. Tell me your thoughts on this, Mike. It feels to me like baseball salaries and I don't even know if it's the perception of value of players, but just the market value of players, you know, what teams are paying for them, is greater and has increased at a greater rate than than each team or the average team's own perception of what its budget should be. So in other words, you know, take the Royals, for example. If the Royals in a vacuum said, you know, here's the budget that we want, they'd probably say they want a $90 to $100 million budget. It's probably where they would like to be. But there's no place for a contract like what David Price got in a budget like that when you're trying to fill out the rest of a major league roster. So it just kind of feels to me like there's some incongruous things that are happening there. I mean, do you feel that same way, or do you think team budgets are following appropriately?
Well, for all of baseball, revenue's up, and the sport is, you know, there's always a column once a year that, oh, baseball's dying and this demographic and yada, yada. But the money's huge. I mean, ratings are immense. Attendance is huge in most markets. You know, it's strong. It's a heck of a sport for money-making purposes. I mean, everybody's making money in baseball right now. And so it's like, TV contracts are huge, you know, like billion-dollar contracts, like the Dodgers, it's crazy. So there's a lot of money in baseball, and so it's natural as that, you know, as years go by, that the salaries are going to continue to go up. It is kind of difficult though when you got a guy like David Price, $31 million. I mean, that immediately narrows it down to like four contenders to get him. It's just such a big chunk of money. And it makes it difficult for a team like the Royals who want to stay around $100 million when that guy would cover a third of their payroll, basically, as one, you know, one player. You know, for comparison's sake, and of course, you know, it's a few years ago. I mean, their opening day payroll in 2011 was $38 million. So, I mean, this one guy basically covers their entire opening day payroll with, you know, a few others. You could have David Price and a few guys making the league minimum. And that's about it. That's what you could do. You couldn't field the full team that way. So it is, it's pretty big. I mean, as, you know, as teams kind of decide if this guy's worth it, well, they've decided he's worth it. So it's pretty crazy. It's, you know, David Price in 1 year is going to make, I haven't even looked at this, but I've got Alex Gordon pulled up. So let's just use him as an example. Alex Gordon in his major league career has made $41 million to this point as a big leaguer since 2007. And that's Alex Gordon. You know, that's, you know, an all-star guy, $41 million. David Price will make 3/4 of that in one season next year. That's a lot.
Wow.
It's a lot of money.
Yeah. What's so fascinating to me about all this thing is just that the baseball salary, I mean, they're just out of control. And the most interesting part is kind of like what we talked about in the first segment with Ben Zobrist, where there is, I think teams actually have a decent handle on the appropriate value for players. What I don't think is happening is that the market value sticks, because the player's determined value sticks, because I think if you asked the majority of teams in baseball, they would probably say that, okay, Ben Zobrist, he's probably worth, from a realistic standpoint, $12, $13 million, you know, maybe 14 if a team really, really likes him. But he's definitely going to make in that $16 million range, and he's probably going to push towards the 18. And it's because teams are going over, there's a team out there that wants him bad enough that they will overpay. So, you know, some of the arguments are, well, if that's what a team will pay for him, that's the market value. It's like, well, not necessarily, yeah. Because it's not a true, you know, I mean, I guess it is kind of a true market, but it's hard to describe necessarily, because it's, you know, there's no regulation on what kind of a contract you can sign. I guess technically there is, because players union will challenge a contract if they don't think that it's appropriate. It's just so fascinating to me to see that kind of tug of war take place, where the perceived value of a player starts out at a place that everyone seems to be comfortable with, and then before you know it, they make 20% more on an average annual value basis, and just because whatever you think a player's worth, there's always a team willing to pay more, and usually it's those top 5 to 10 teams in the league that can afford it, because they don't care about overpaying, because they want that asset. And it's just crazy fascinating to me to see that.
It's also, you know, when you look at just how salaries have advanced, I just kind of glanced through some bigger contracts. You know, Matt Kemp back in, 2012, you know, signed a deal for 8 years, $160 million. Well, you know, in 2011, he hit 39 homers, and he was second place in the MVP voting, and was 26 years old, and signs a contract with the Dodgers, not a free agent one. So, I mean, they were, you know, just extending him. But still, that's $20 million a year. You know, you look at Alex Gordon now, a few years later, he's going to be 32 on opening day next year, and he's going to be probably getting something like 5 years and $100 million. So that same annual average value, but 6 years older than Kemp was, and doesn't have that, you know, he's been very good, but he doesn't have that, you know, top five MVP vote kind of resume. He doesn't have, you know, Matt Kemp entering peak years. You know, he's in his, you know, maybe at the end of his peak years. So, you know, just that's another example of how it just inflates every year, because, you know, they sign Matt Kemp. Well, now the next year, this free agent wants Matt Kemp money, and somebody has to give him an extra $2 million a year to ensure that they get him. And then, you know, it just goes on to the next year and the next year, and they just keep going up. I mean, as long as the money's there within the league, it's going to happen. but it also does really kind of skew things because you can't have one team that just jumps in and is like, they're going to offer a crazy contract. Who was it? Jay Happ, you know, who has bounced around a little bit. Not somebody you would kind of look at as a great starter. He's going to get 3 years and $36 million from the Blue Jays. And that's, you know, not a burdensome contract, but that's $12 million a year. That's a fair amount of money. That's like James Shields in 2012, 2013 kind of money. So, you know, I wouldn't equate Jay Happ with James Shields, but that's just how in a couple of years, you know, as you know, players are available, you know, one team decides that they need to sign him. And so now anybody who's slightly better than Jay Happ, well, they're going to expect to make similar money. And so it just keeps going and going. And you know, sometimes you get priced out and sometimes the players miscalculate. You know, guys like Irvin Santana, when he was signing with the Braves, really thought that he was going to be a $100 million guy and teams weren't willing to do that. And he took 1 year deal and, you know, just went from there. But yeah, I mean, it is kind of crazy. And it does seem like the way teams value players and contracts is kind of, you don't always understand what they're doing. And you kind of have to just look at it in the context of every other team, every other player, and just kind of see how it relates and not necessarily look at the absolute numbers and kind of guess from there. It's tough, you know. I mean, guys like Fangraphs and Baseball Prospectus and other analysts have tried to kind of come up with a value of the win above replacement. And, you know, that keeps going up. It seems like it's about $7.5 million per win, whereas a couple of years ago it was $5.5-6 million a win. And so, you know, those quality players, they do cost more. And so for a team like the Royals, if they're willing to spend more on their payroll, then they can stay afloat, or otherwise they have to really be smart about how they spend their money and, you know, how they develop players so that you've got league minimum guys who are producing and providing a lot of value, but not necessarily hitting the payroll so that you can go out and get, say, Alex Gordon for $18, $19 million a year. Whereas you have Christian Colon, who's making $700,000 and can play a serviceable second base, and that's kind of where your kind of savings come through. So I don't know. It seems like every year there's a new big contract, and it's always really crazy. And David Price has basically set up Zach Greinke to get $32 million a year for a few years. So I'm sure that'll happen in the next week or two. And it'll be the whole thing all over again.
What will be the most fascinating going forward, I think, for me, will be, because a few years ago you mentioned Matt Kemp, and you know it was roughly 10-ish years ago, was it? Maybe a little bit more, when Alex Rodriguez signed that first like mega contract. Yeah. Of, you know, 10 years, $250 million, whatever the hell it was. And it was kind of the – I can't remember if he was the first to have a contract with an average annual value over $20 million. Was he the first?
I'm not sure.
I'd have to do some research on that. But if he wasn't the first, he was one of the first. But
I would think he would have to be among the first.
Yeah. And – he was, you know, maybe Barry Bonds was before him, but I still don't think so.
Manny Ramirez from 2001 to 2008 got $20 million a year. I'm looking at Cott's contracts on Baseball Prospectus, which they don't sponsor us in any way, but it's good resource.
Nonetheless.
Yeah. Derek Jeter made about 19 from 2001 to 2010. Where is Rodriguez? I don't see him. Oh, $25,200,000 starting in 2001 through 2010 for average annual value.
Okay, so you know, he was one of the pioneers on that, and it was a huge deal because I remember it was kind of like, oh man, is somebody going to get $20 million a year. That was a very huge threshold to cross. And the amount of time it took to get from, you know, Tom Glavine signing an, oh my God, $10 million contract to $10 million a year contract to $20 million a year contract, you know, has been eclipsed in the time it's taken to go from that to $30 million, you know, and it just seems like the $30 million threshold is just kind of, you know, doesn't seem like it's nearly as big of a deal anymore. And it's been slowly climbing up. And it's like, man, it's just not that it's not a big deal anymore, but just that it's not as big of a deal as the $20 million threshold was, because everybody's kind of seen it coming. And but what'll be interesting is going forward, and we won't get to know until, you know, 5 or 7 years from now. But those contracts we just talked about, your Manny Ramirez, your Derek Jeter, your Alex Rodriguez, those were the exceptions. You know, now for any big name player like that, it's the rule, right? So, you know, you've got, I mean, guys like Josh Hamilton even getting those crazy contracts. You've got Albert Pujols making that kind of money, Clayton Kershaw, David Price, you know, Johnny Cueto's going to sign that huge deal. Zach Greinke, you know, Max Scherzer's making $20 million a year. Now Jordan Zimmerman is making $20 million a year. So, you know, it's, there's all these huge contracts and they're all, you know, roughly, you know, no less than five, usually in that 7 to 10 year range. So when we get to the point that these players are older and less productive, what is that going to do? Because baseball has, it's not like football where you just cut somebody, you don't have to pay them. Baseball is guaranteed money. So a couple of things can happen. You can have teams that, you know, try and work out a deal like, okay, well, we're paying David Price $30 million and he's 37 years old. We'll pay $20 million if you take him and pay $10 million to a team, I don't know, who's maybe hoping to catch lightning in a bottle for his kind of at the end, near the end of his career, for a David Price or something. But because that's how old he'll be at the end of this contract. He'll be 37 years old making $32 million. So he'll almost be making more millions than years old is, to think about that. And actually next year he will be.
Jeez.
So, which is nuts. But so there's that option, but and then there's the, you know, the second option of just teams are going to be loaded with these huge contracts and they're going to be stuck. And, you know, David Price isn't going to be the last signing Boston makes this year. And they're not thinking about 7 years from now. They're thinking about winning the World Series next year.
Mm-hmm.
And that's fine. And if I was a team, that's how, if I was a fan, that's how I'd want them to be. But it'll be really interesting to see how that comes about. And because then in terms of who can afford David Price, there's only five teams in the league that'll be able to afford that kind of a salary at that time. So then you're, you know, your trade targets are incredibly limited and nobody's going to want him if he's not producing, of course. So then I guess kind of a third option possibly is something that I think Andrew Friedman's kind of sneakily done recently that you've seen kind of, I've read some articles about it and seen some people talk about it, but it's not like a huge topic. So before, when Friedman was with the Rays, he had to make these incredibly shrewd moves, try and find, he had to be very Dayton Moore-like. You know, even though he was, I would definitely say, I would never say he's trying to be like Dayton Moore, but just in terms of, got to kind of scour for those deals of finding something, a diamond in the rough type of a Chris Young or Ryan Madsen, somebody that you know, with your staff, you can get something out of. So that was how he used to operate. But now he's got this limitless money in LA. They had a $234 million payroll last year. Over 200.
That's a lot of money.
So what he's kind of started to do now is he'll make these trades with teams that want to unload some of these huge contracts and take the player with a bad contract, but get these prospects with him. So he's saying, hey, I've got an owner who doesn't care, tells me I have carte blanche with whatever money I want to spend. So I'm going to take your $20 million a year. You're going to give me that top five prospect. And then I'm going to ride out this crappy contract as a sunk cost. I'm going to let this guy develop. And then I'm going to have an all-star player for the league minimum. And you're going to be out of both an all-star player who was making $20 million and an all-star player making the league minimum. So, you know, it's not, he's not done a ton of it, but you can kind of see the pieces, and people have kind of talked about how it could be revolutionary if he continues on that path. But again, there's only a few teams that can make those kind of plays. So
yeah, that like,
I'm incredibly fascinated to see how it goes. Now, of course, the fourth option is that it all blows up, and by the time we get to 2022, when David Price's contract is over, $30 million is nothing, and yeah, the Royals can take him. You know, right. It doesn't even matter. So, and it's $50 million is the new 30. You know, so I guess that's option number four. And God, I hope it doesn't get there.
Just wait till Bryce Harper hits free agency.
Oh, good God!
I mean, that's $40 million.
You're easily. Literally going to have to give a piece of ownership your team to Bryce Harper.
He will just own the team. Just going back to your part about the Dodgers, I mean, Bronson Arroyo was kind of the guy for this. He made $9.5 million last year, was hurt all season. The Diamondbacks had him, you know, starting in 2014. Last year, Tommy John surgery. They ended up sending him to Atlanta. Atlanta sent just a whatever prospect and agreed to take on his contract. But in order to do so, they got, you know, Touki Toussaint, who was a first-round pick by Arizona in 2014. And so that's one example. And then later, the Dodgers traded for him, and they got Alex Wood in the deal. So they were like, it's basically the whole idea of exactly like you said, you know, we're going to take this guy on, but you're going to send us, you know, Alex Wood and I think Luis Avilon is the other kind of guy. You know, just that's just kind of the game that they're playing, which if you can do it, great. I mean, if you can handle it and make the roster work and everything, that's one way to do it. For other teams like the Royals, though, it seems like that's why their strategy and their policy basically now is 4-year deal. They just don't seem like they want to do anything bigger than a 4-year deal, unless it's like an extension for, you know, a young player. But for example, like a 4-year free agency deal, you're not committing yourself deeply like you would for a 7, 8, 10-year contract, you know, where you're looking at, okay, maybe in 4 years, we're going to get the performance we expect, but as soon as that guy starts to age, it declines. You know, most guys, when they hit the market, if you look at the free agency list, most of these guys are, you know, in the early 30s or mid 30s. You know, you don't want to give, you know, something like Ben Zobrist, that fourth year that he's looking for, that's going to be the sticking point for the Royals, because they're probably comfortable with a 3-year deal, because they figure they can get 2 good years out of him. Maybe that third one is not great. But asking them to do 4 years, that's difficult. You know, Alex Gordon, you know, he's 32 now. Probably looking at 5 or 6 years, the Royals probably really want to stay at 4 years, just because they are already seeing that he's probably at his peak. You know, he was injured last year, so it obviously his wins above replacement is down, but he's about an average 5-win player based on Fangraphs and Baseball Reference. Would you expect him next year to be a 5-win guy? Probably. You know, could probably still hit at about the same rate. His defense might not be elite, but it could probably be above average. He's probably got another above average defensive season in him. And then after that, you know, a lot of his value is starting to decline because he's getting into his mid 30s. And so they don't want to end up paying for 2-3 decline years just to get him for 2. Now they might, because it's Gordon and he's a special case. He's a workout freak. They know that a lot of his value is still in having some power, leadership, on base percentage. Even if he's only an average left fielder, that's still okay. Things like that, you know, it's Gordon. They know him. They've known him since, you know, they scouted him before the draft. They drafted him, had him in their system. They've had him this whole time. So that might be, you know, an okay deal for them. But somebody else who they don't know as well, you know, you look at Edinson Volquez. They signed him to a two-year deal, give him an option year. Kendry Morales, 2 years. You know, Ryan Madsen, Chris Young, they're giving them one-year deals. And they're really just trying to, like, hit and run and get that last or those last two good years out of a guy and move on. And to me, it seems like they're trying to do that now, especially because there's also the window. You know, you look at 2017, Eric Hosmer, Mike Moustakas, Alcides Escobar, Wade Davis. These guys are probably going to be gone. Probably, maybe you can keep Kane around with an extension, but you're probably looking at 2018 season with a lot of guys that haven't played yet. And so, you know, that might be an argument why they might go get Gordon, because $18 million in 2018, when everybody else is making $500,000, that's not a big deal. But, you know, for the next 2 years, that's a big hit. You know, so it's just like they want to be sure for Gordon that you're looking at a guy who you can get the value you expect now and probably next year, or 2016 to 2017, and then you see what you can do. And if they think that he can be that five-win guy for the next 2 years, then it's probably something they're okay with. If they think that he's going to be on a sharper decline than that, then it's you know, totally different game, and they're probably not going to budge on that fourth and fifth year. You look at Billy Butler, I think they identified quickly that he was in a quick decline. And so when he came to them and gave them the opportunity to match that three-year, $30 million contract from Oakland, they passed. And, you know, last year he had a pretty poor season, and the Royals signed Morales for a pretty small deal, and they look like geniuses for it. And Butler, who isn't even 30 yet, looks like he's probably, you know, going to be clinging on as his body you know, wears down and his skills erode. Sad to say, but yeah, he's probably going to be declining pretty quickly. And so the Royals are doing what they have to do as a small market team to minimize that risk down the line, so that they're not stuck in 4 years with no flexibility because they have this $25 million contract here and this $15 million contract there. And they've got, you know, $50 million tied up in three guys. You know, so they have to stay flexible. They have to try to, you know, bounce around and see what they can do. And that's going to leave them out for guys like Price and Greinke and Stanton and Harper and, you know, whoever down the line. But, you know, that's where it comes to development and creativeness and, you know, working the game so that you can get the small advantages like they did this year.
Yeah, and, you know, a big glaring kind of example of what you talk about when you know, the Royals are betting on doing that hit-and-run type of thing. I mean, Albert Pujols, right, signed a 10-year, $240 million deal with L.A. in 2012. Excuse me. So with St. Louis in 11 seasons, he had 9 All-Star games or All-Star appearances. He was he had a 328, 420, 617 line with a 170 OPS plus, averaged 41 home runs a year. Okay. And then, so LA was betting, okay, if we're going to pay him for 10 years, they had to be at least thinking they were going to get 4 years of that caliber of play from him. And then a couple decline years, or a couple of years where the decline starts and then it really starts to drop off after that. And I think they were willing to pay that money on the back end to get it on the front end, but instead they've gotten a 126 OPS plus, an 804 OPS, and averaging 32 home runs a year. Which, I mean, I'd take 32 home runs in a heartbeat, but when you're paying for 41 and you're getting 32, it's a bit of a difference. And so the Angels were betting that they could get that same kind of production out of him, and they lost that bet. And so it's affected him. Like, he's still a good player. He's still putting up good numbers, mm-hmm. but he's not putting up good numbers relative to the amount of money he's being paid. And so he's having, you know, they can afford to kind of eat that, but then in a couple of years when Mike Trout becomes a free agent, you know, if the Angels don't roll up the Brinks truck and just dump every bit of money they have at him, people are going to just go crazy saying, what are you doing? Why aren't you keeping this guy? And you have to wonder how much the commitment they have to Albert Pujols, how much that's going to affect their ability to pay Mike Trout. So that's the situation that you kind of nailed it when you said, you know, that's the type of thing that the Rays just don't want to, they don't want to deal with. And I completely understand it, you know, because they're, if they get into a situation with a bad contract, they can't afford to eat it. They just can't. And so, you know, if they, you know, make a mistake, like when they sign Omar Infante, you know, they have not gotten the production that they paid for it. They don't have the, relative to no. baseball contracts, they're not paying them a ton, roughly $8 million a year in terms of annual average value. And so it's not a huge amount, but it is for the Royals. And, you know, they're not getting that value out of him, but they, in 2 years, they'll be done with it, you know? Mm-hmm. So if he's, if he was giving you that kind of production, and you gave him a, you know, 7 year, $120 million contract, then you'd be like, oh crap, we got five more years of this and we're paying him $15 million or whatever that average annual value is. It's like, man, that really sucks. And that's going to hamper us, you know? So the Royals are very good at properly evaluating players, and, or at least they have been in the last few years, I should say. For the most part, they make mistakes, yeah, they, like in Omar Infante.
Stubbed their toe. Yeah, Infante, I liked that deal when they did it, but
I liked it too.
He's been hurt, and he's been pretty, pretty poor.
Yeah, and, you know, but the Edinson Volquez, they did a really good job of doing their homework on that and giving him the proper value.
Vargas and was he's a already signing. Guthrie for a couple of years was okay.
Guthrie did well. Kendrys Morales, you talked about, Mike, has been great. I mean, basically, Kendrys Morales and Edinson Volquez on two-year contracts have, in baseball terms, have basically already gotten the value of their entire contracts in their first year.
Absolutely.
So if they just give you average play out of their second year, then it's a huge success for those signings, which is just something that, you know, you just don't see a ton of. So it'll be incredibly interesting to see how this thing with Gordon unfolds. I think ultimately the Royals are going to cave and they're going to pay him more than they think that he's worth, more than they're comfortable with, because it's going to get down to 0 hour. Alex Gordon's going to have a offer from the Cubs or from the Tigers, God forbid. Huh. And the Royals are going to say, we just can't match that offer. And then they're going to picture seeing Alex Gordon in that uniform playing in their park against them. And they're going to like say, 10, 12 times. All right, just here's the check. Just write your number and we'll get this done. You're going to be a Royal for life and that's it. So I think that's what's going to happen. And it'll probably end up hurting the Royals, you know, in the last year or two of his contract. But I'm okay with it.
Yeah, it's one of those where it's just like there's so many times where guys left and you kind of, I mean, Gordon is a special guy. Gordon's a potential retired number type of guy. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't think he's going to end up he's 32. He's coming off of this groin injury. He looked, you know, his stolen bases were down last year. I don't think you can assume that he's going to make up the same value defensively over the next couple
seasons. You could tell his range suffered this year.
Yeah, and before the injury even. I think...
Not adversely, but it suffered.
Yeah, I mean, I think, like I said before, I think he'd still be above average defensively. I don't think it'd be like Torrey Hunter where the defense just disappeared.
Over like Carlos Beltran, kind of in...
Yeah, graceful, yeah. Graceful. By the end of the contract, I would think for the Royals, he's probably, if they sign him, their idea is probably 2 years in left field, and then he takes over first base when Hosmer leaves. Like, that just seems to me like what they're going to do, which means his offense has to be bigger to get the value, but, you know, maybe it works that way. So, you know, it's possible. So I don't know. I'm just looking ahead at I'm looking at Detroit, their layout for the next few years. And a lot of these guys they signed in like 2013, like Anibal Sanchez and Ian Kinsler and Justin Verlander. In 2018, who did I just name? Verlander, Sanchez, Kinsler. Well, they've got buyouts, so this is a bad example. But let's just look at Verlander, Miguel Cabrera, Victor Martinez, and Jordan Zimmermann. Those four guys are going to make $28 million, $30 million, $18 million, and $24 million each, good respectively. God. I mean, just right there, you're looking at $100 million, and that's four players.
And they offered Scherzer, what was that contract? It was $147 million or something? Was it 7 years?
I think it was just below what he actually signed for.
I mean, that could have been on top of that.
Yeah, and you're looking at Verlander, who's already shown signs of falling apart. Cabrera, who was hurt a lot of last year. Martinez, who is on the downslope easily. Sanchez was hurt last year. I mean, if the guys that they're signing now are definitely, it's like they're looking to do it in the next 2 years.
Yeah.
You know, and then they're just going to, I don't know what they're going to do.
Even with the Tigers, you've seen it because their bullpen has been dog shit for years.
And they can't do anything about it.
They can't. And because they're putting all their money in these other places. And so they're betting on the fact that their star power is enough to overcome a more complete team like the Royals. And the Royals have shown it's not. You know, so the idea, and you know, you've heard a lot on the radio, people talking from a national perspective of a lot of teams, a lot of front offices are trying to emulate what the Royals have done. And as flattering and as awesome as that is to hear, like even thinking about the Royals, if they were to try to repeat what they have done themselves, I don't even know that it's possible. Just because like everything came together perfectly for the Royals, and that's kind of what has to happen. You know, the Marlins, I guess, were able to do it twice, where they built from within and just kind of everything came together at the right time, and they won a couple World Series there. So, you know, I suppose it's possible, but it's really hard to replicate getting a roster like what the Royals put together. And a lot of credit goes to Dayton Moore for doing it. So now it's gonna be, you know, how good he really is if he can keep this thing going through some departures. But yeah, I mean the Tigers, their weaknesses show even more, especially when it gets to the most important parts, like in the playoffs, because they can't bolster their weaknesses because they've got so much of this money tied up in other places.
And now after the Giants and the Royals and the Cardinals have done so much in the World Series with kind of offenses. Well, you know, now defense and relief pitching is becoming a commodity the same way that like on base percentage and power has been a commodity. And so they've got their money tied up in these big name guys, and the value for relief pitchers and defensive players is going up. And so they're in even tougher spots. I mean, they did go trade for Francisco Rodriguez a couple weeks ago to be their closer, but they got to get to him. You know, it's like, it's not enough to have a closer. I mean, the Royals had closers, but they didn't have the middle relief, you know, in 2006, you know, yeah. They had Soria a couple years and, you know, didn't matter in 2008. They didn't have anybody to get the ball to him. So, yep. You know, if you're relying on Blaine Hardy to be your bridge to your closer, it's not going to go very well. It's just going to be painful for you. So nothing against Blaine Hardy. He's a better pitcher than a lot of guys, but, you know, he's not Wade Davis. He's not Kelvin Herrera. He's not Jalen Betances and guys like that.
And you saw it with, you know, firsthand, the Royals saw it with the Mets. You know, they have a better starting rotation than what the Tigers do, even with Jordan Zimmermann. And they have a better closer, I would argue, in Juris Familia, probably today. Well, from a track record standpoint, you couldn't argue. But, you know, as of today, you could make that argument. But, you know, regardless, you saw it. It didn't matter. I mean, not only did he himself blow a few saves, three to be exact, in the World Series, but you know, getting to him was tough. And you know, they're throwing out guys like Bartolo Colon and Tyler Clippard, and it just, it didn't work. I mean, it got him to the World Series. You can't say that it didn't work, but you know, it failed him when they needed it the most. And so, I mean, you know, you can't, I think if the playoffs have proved anything, when you look at, I mean, think back to when you go to 2011, right? I mean, the Cardinals won the World Series in 2011 or even 2010. The Giants won in 2010, Cardinals in 2011, Giants in 2012, Red Sox in 2013, Giants in 2014, and now the Royals in 2015. So the last six World Series, you know, only one of the traditional big budget, big market teams have won. You know, Cardinals, Royals, Giants all play a similar off brand of baseball than the kind of big, the, you know, big name teams do. So, you know, maybe things are trending in that direction, and, you know, hopefully they are for the Royals' sake.
Yeah.
But it's, you know, those teams have always had complete teams, you know, where you've been, you know, you've been able to, you know, the Giants have had a string of very, very good starting pitchers, but, you know, they also had, you know, guys like Sergio Romo and Brian Wilson and relievers that gave them a lot of very good quality innings that they could count on when they needed them the most. Cardinals always seem to pump out very good starting pitchers.
I could probably sign with the Cardinals and probably throw 30 innings of
somehow
2.5 ERA baseball. Just like, oh, okay. This is so easy.
It's just, you know, that type of a thing is when you've got so much money tied up, and, you know, the Dodgers could afford to go and just buy out everybody probably and have a $300 million payroll. It'll happen eventually. But
yeah,
it's just a question of, you know, at some point the ownership does step in and say, you know, we just can't do this anymore. We can't pay any more money. We're at $230 million for our payroll. It's over. Just make it work with what you have. And so then you got to stop and, where does that, you know, where does your weakness start to show? And then you get a team like the Royals or the Cardinals or the Giants, and they can exploit it, and they do. And that's what happens. And the Royals are world champions. Did I fit that in yet? Have I fit that in, the Royals are world champions yet?
It still happened.
Yes, it did. So I think with our kind of final point, we can talk about this. As we talk about the exorbitant salaries that baseball has and will have moving forward, something to think about here. And we've talked about previously the Royals, how they should, or at least in our opinion, how they should kind of frame the argument of I shouldn't say the Royals, how Dayton Moore, if he's talking to David Glass about what the budget needs to be, about the amount of money that he needs, here's how he frames the argument. We talked about how you say, okay, give me, you know, just to throw a number out, $150 million this year and next year, and then we'll make a run at this thing. We'll get tons of revenue with the fans and with merchandising. And then, you know, the mass exodus after 2017, drop that payroll down to a manageable range in the $100 million range. We'll still have some veteran players to try and bridge the gap, and we'll just try and build up with our minor leagues and do it all over again. You know, that's just the short of it. But another kind of added wrinkle Mike and I were looking at is, so if you go back to 2011, call 2011 when this thing all kind of first started coming together. That's when Alcides Escobar and Lorenzo Cain arrived, even though Cain was in the minors for all of 2011. And then that's when Hosmer came up, Moose came up, Duffy came up. That's when everything really started coming together. So if you start there, you've got the Royals at $38 million payroll opening day in 2011. Then you've got them at $64 million in 2012. So right there, you're right around $100 million. It was $81 million in 2013, so it's $181 million. $92 million last year in 2014, so that's at, you know, $275 million. And it was $112 million. This year in 2015. So just under $400 million in a 5-year span. Okay. So that is $80 million a year for your payroll, right? So that's not a ton. That's if you said to David Glass, hey, we're going to have an $80 million payroll, he would love that number.
Right. We're going to improve our winning percentage
every year
over 4 or 5 seasons.
Yeah. So then let's say you tack on $150 million payroll for the next 2 years, right? So that's an added $300. So then, or $300 million. So then you're at $700 million over a span of 7 years, and you're still only averaging $100 million. And you, if you're David Glass, you think, okay, it's not ideal as far as making money goes, but as far as fielding a competitive team, it's a number I can live with, and you can still make money. So that's something where it doesn't work like that, because, you know, every year is a separate year with a separate budget. You don't just take all your excess and then put it into next year's salary and everything. So it's not quite that. It doesn't work like that. And David Glass and Dayton Moore, they know that. But it's just kind of interesting if you look at it that way, to try and frame it from the standpoint of, yeah, it's a lot of money now, but when you look at years past and the amount of money we've saved, and then going forward, because then after those $250 million, then if you drop back down to $100 million, you know, you're still maintaining that $100 million range. So, you know, if you're imagining a line graph, you know, it's the actual figure is bouncing up and down over that span, but then the line that represents the average for the whole time is staying relatively flat. So, you know, just a different way of thinking about it, that maybe I'm just trying to talk myself into hoping the Royals open up the pocketbooks, but I don't know. It seems logical to me.
It makes sense. I mean, if you're considering it the period from basically the process revealed, right, or something. I don't know what they call it.
I love that. That's, you know, awesome. That's 2011. 2011. The process revealed.
2017. I mean, that's your period. That's your window. And in that spot, if they're spending that kind of money, do, you know, players stay healthy and improve and produce. I mean, in that period, you could have 4 playoff appearances. You could have 2 pennants, and then whatever they do the next 2, you know, if they make the playoffs 2016 to 2017. I mean, they're going to open up as favorites for the Central. Unless a lot of big signings start happening with, you know, Cleveland or Detroit or whomever, you know, so it's basically you're sitting there saying, well, you could probably in that 7-season period be in the playoffs 3 times, 4 times, you know, with the World Series win already banked. It's like, and, you know, after 2017, maybe it's a little rough talent-wise because you got a lot of young guys. You got Mondesi and Bubba and Zimmer and other guys coming up who don't have a lot of experience. But then you get to start it again, and you start investing a little bit more as players develop and as they start to hit their peak years. You look at a guy like Hosmer now. He's going to hit free agency at 28 years old, but that puts him in his peak years right now. That puts Moustakas in his peak. That puts Kane probably at his peak. So you're investing on those guys who are in their ideal period for them to be productive. And I think that gives you the opportunity to maybe take a shot on a guy like Gordon, who, you know, already from, you know, being in the system for 10 years and who you can probably figure for 2 years is going to give you reasonable production that you expect, even though the decline years might be a little bit painful. You know, he's supplementing the other guys who are, you know, your rising stars, your current stars, while being at that level himself. And so if it averages out over the entire run, yeah, that makes pretty good sense. It's like investing in a company and slowly you keep adding and improving. You know, maybe you improve your machinery, maybe you hire more people, maybe you do this or that, so that it's more productive overall. And then by the time you're 5 years in, it's a well-oiled machine. It's like that could work. You know, maybe that's the way they're talking about it. Maybe not. I mean, like you said, it's a year-by-year thing. But if you look at it on the whole and in the big picture, David Glass has been the owner since 2000. You know, it's not like he's going to be surprised that there's a different budget every year. Now the difference is he's building off of a winning team.
Yeah, and, you know, I look at the – the A's as a possible example, they're kind of in a similar spot, you think, just, you know, in terms of market and typical payroll size for them and things like that. The A's, you had their kind of big window that they weren't able to capitalize on like the Royals did. In starting in 2000, they made the playoffs 4 years in a row. Then they kind of, you know, they had some good seasons, but didn't make the playoffs, and they made the playoffs again. And then they kind of took, you know, in all that time span, they had seasons of wins of 91, 102, 103, 96, 91, 88, and 93 in a 7 year span. So five times of the playoffs in 7 years, and, you know, averaging 90 plus wins each year. You know, the Royals are, assuming they were to take that, or take our model as we're petitioning it, could be in that similar type category. And as you said, Mike, with the World Series win banked and two pennants banked already, which the A's never got any of those.
Yeah.
But then after that run, you know, a lot of their players left. They kind of took a step back, had to retool, had 5 years where they didn't make the playoffs, below 500 team, but then they came back up again and they got it. And they had three years in a row where they made the playoffs. Again, they couldn't cash in, but that's, you know, different discussion. But it's just kind of goes to illustrate that, you know, the Royals can kind of go for that model of, you know, it doesn't have to, you know, it's okay if it's not the Cardinals every year, where you're making the playoffs every year and winning the division. You know, if you're being competitive, you go for it in your window. And then they've already capitalized, so try and capitalize on it even more, and then let that window close, spend a few years, build it up again, and move forward with that, and then kind of tackle each one as it comes, and think of it as an overall, you know, versus, so when you say, you know, the, let's see, the A's have made the playoffs 8 of the last 15 years, you know, that sounds pretty good. I'd yeah. take that. But, you know, as long as the Royals are competitive in between, you know, as long as they don't drop to 2005 levels where they're losing 19 games in a row, right, and all this crap, you know, as long as they stay competitive, you know, the A's won, you know, those years, you know, no less than 74 wins in any of those, which 74 wins, not that great, but, you know, they had an 81
win. It's not
win.
59.
Exactly. So if you can do that and you maintain, stay competitive, even when you're not in the playoffs, and then work your way back up to that playoff caliber team, then point of all that being that the fans aren't just going to go away. You know, it took a long, long time of just awful baseball and terrible losing to really push the fans away to the point where, you know, in 2006-ish, you're getting 1.4 million people to come to the stadium, you know? And that took a really, really long time to get to that point, because everybody loved the Royals after their glory days, as well they should have. And so, you know, you're getting that goodwill back, 2.7 million fans. You're going to have roughly that number, 2.5 million probably to 2.7 million for the next few years, just based on the goodwill that you've gotten from this year. Mm-hmm. So if you can keep that rolling and just, you know, go after, you know, get in the playoffs a couple more times, then it would take a really, really long time of really, really crappy baseball to lose that. So your bar of in 2011 of where you had your budget because of all these different factors like poor attendance and things like that, that's now increased, you know, and that's, it's going to be there even if you're not winning because of the winning that you've already done. So there's a lot of factors that you can look at that if you're being forward looking to where you can say it's going to hurt a little bit to do it now, but it'll pay off.
I hope they keep bringing in the fans like that, because that's just money.
Mm-hmm.
That's just money. And that means that you can keep pouring it back into the team and keep winning. And then, you know, maybe they can invest when all these guys leave, or maybe they extend somebody. That's ideal. That's the ideal way to do it.
Yeah. Because the opposite way of doing that, which is what the Marlins did, you know, win a World Series in 97, dismantle the whole thing, trade all your players for prospects, and then rebuild from there, and they win the whole thing in 2003, and then they completely tore it apart and redid it all again. You know, that's the other option. And, you know, that's not fair to the fans because, you know, in Miami, their ownership has shown that they don't give a shit about the fans.
They don't.
That's their prerogative.
They're awful. I don't know how you can be a Marlins fan. You just have
I don't know.
Literally have no way to see any other team, I think.
It's no secret as to why Marlins man looks like he has more fun at Royals games than he probably does in his own ballpark. So, you know, but so the Royals can do it this way, still try and go after it in this window and still be respectful to the fans and give them a quality product. Cause as you said, when, you know, if they had a, you know, after this possible mass exodus in 2018 or 2017, there will be some growing pains with some of the younger players. You know, if you've got Bubba Starling coming up and you've got Raul Mondesi coming up and Miguel Almonte and Kyle Zimmer and stuff, you know, hopefully they can work in enough to that they'll be ready to go at that point. But, you know, eventually your hope is that Bubba Starling is the next Alex Gordon or Lorenzo Cain, you know, and Raul Mondesi is the next Alcides Escobar, and or maybe even better. And so the dips aren't quite as low as they used to be, and the highs are as high as we've already seen in 2015. So, I mean, that's kind of, you know, that's the idea for what you hope the Royals can accomplish. So I wish we could just press a button and fast forward to 3 months from now so we know what's going on. We know what the Royals – because this offseason is going to tell you what the Royals decided in terms of where they think they are and where they think they're going.
Yeah. Yeah. I think if they go for Gordon, I think they feel like they're going to go for it the next 2 years and just really jump in. So we'll see. We'll have to, you know, if we fast forward, if we have that power, we ought to just send this to David Glass and let him mull it over. And another thing we need to do is still get you that Omar Infante jersey.
Yes, the Kickstarter. We'll have to start that soon.
Maybe someone will trade for him.
That's very possible. So,
goodness, probably not.
Well, with that, I think we'll leave you this evening. We just kind of wanted to, with tonight's show, just kind of get an overview of, like we said, where we think the Royals could go, where they possibly could go, get some news out there, some discussion about just baseball in general, because you're going to see a lot of that. The contracts start moving soon. And I wouldn't be surprised if by the next time we record, we have an answer on Alex Gordon and Ben Zobrist. So, you know, that'll be interesting to see what happens with them. And like we just said, whatever happens with those two is going to tell you where the Royals think they are and where they could be going. So it'll be a fun off season, and you know, it's finally getting fired up here. So stick with us for the rest of the off season. We'll have plenty of takes for you on the free agency, and I'm sure somebody else is going to make a crazy signing. Zach Greinke will have a $470 million contract that he'll sign, and all this stuff. So it's going to be interesting. It's going to be fun. I'm looking forward to it. Mike's looking forward to it. So yeah, thanks everyone for listening. We can't thank you enough for being a part of the Royals community, being, you know, listening to the show, helping us do what we do. And speaking of which, you know, big shout out to Kelly, who's always been a huge supporter of the show and helps us, you know, ensures that we can do what we do. And, you know, if you ever want to go have a drink, watch some football games in the off season, or, you know, just miss baseball season, then definitely go out to Kelly's and shoot Mike or I a tweet or something. You know, there's a good, you know, there's always a chance we're headed that way ourselves, because that's our bar of choice. And that's not even a sponsorship.
That was the OG post podcast bar before they sponsored us
That was kind of how the sponsorship started. We used to, when we recorded over at the Ice House, and we just roll on over to Kelly's and have a beer and a slice of pizza at Joe's, and Troy would edit the show. And next thing you know, there are sponsors, and, you know, there it is.
And here we are. We're years later.
Years later. Can you believe it, man? Years later.
Crazy.
So, well, with that, we'll leave you this evening. So thanks for listening. We can't tell you how much we appreciate it. Make sure you stop by Kelly's whenever you're next time you're out and you're feeling like you want to have a drink or watch a sporting event or something of that sort. And keep cheering on those Royals, and we'll keep podcasting and have plenty of stuff to talk about in this off season. So thanks again for listening. And as always, go Royals.
Thanks for listening. This has been the Kansas City Baseball Vault. You can find us on Twitter at KC Baseball Vault. You can also find us on Facebook at facebook.com/Kansas City Baseball Vault. If you want to email your thoughts or comments, send those to KansasCityBaseballVault@gmail.com. And don't forget, you can also sign up and subscribe through iTunes, through Stitcher, or you can just go to RoyalsPodcast.com or KansasCityBaseballVault.com for any updates.